Benjamin, thank you for your willingness to share that. For those of you who are at Christmas Eve service, you know that Benjamin spent his Christmas Eve with his mother for a good part of the day in the emergency department at UNC Hillsboro, deep into the morning of Christmas Day, quite sick. But as I've often said, there's no more potent combination than amazing grace and amazing health care. And as the providers and the Holy Spirit went to work and were able to coax him out of his dehydration and fast-track some antibiotics, he is back up and around. I'm grateful for your support, your prayers that you expressed to me and that you offered on his behalf and Janelle's behalf. It is good and wonderful to be a part of this church. And you also did Mackenzie a personal favor today. As an old habit, we said, oh, in the absence of anyone else who do music, Mackenzie, just find something to sing. And so she had in the back of her head this lingering obligation to play special music today. And to relieve her of that meant the world to her. So thank you for that. If you go ahead and open your Bibles to Matthew chapter 2, we're going to be walking through a familiar story there. It actually happens in verses 13 through 23. This is after the visit of the Magi and the after effects, the reverberation, the trouble that is stirred up as these foreign travelers arrive in Jerusalem asking where the one who was born to be king of the Jews was to be found. As we begin today, I do just want to remind you of where we've been through the season of Advent, across Christmas Eve, and then now where we are today. We spent all of these weeks in some way paying attention to and trying to name that flame that doesn't begin with us and it doesn't end with us. And so called this season kindled, a small light that was easy to miss. That first week, it was hope that sort of was sparking in the dark. And that hope grew into a fire, a purifying fire and a clearing fire that would make space for peace to move in. And sometimes we have to make that space. Then the fire would come in a joy that returned, not necessarily with loud trumpets and fanfare, but that joy and the flame of joy would return. Then finally, in the fourth Sunday of Advent, the love that learned the long work of patience and trust, that ember that we have to protect, and by our breath, we can sort of, in many ways, draw out of it more heat, and collaborating with that ember, make a fire that can grow. And then the light that is shared by what is kindled in the church, all of that is bigger than we are. After Christmas, as we walked across Christmas Eve, we remembered how that light stretches beyond what we could ever contain or imagine, even for ourselves. And so the theme has grown with us and has morphed and has challenged and shaped our imaginations, hopefully a little bit. If nothing else, than to look deeply inside the life of the church and realize that we don't have to chase after a flame out there. But the Holy Spirit has kindled within us as Christians and within us as a fellowship the necessary stuff to burn and to shine and to warm the world in the name of the gospel. And so it is for us to notice it. It is for us to tend to it. It is for us to celebrate it. And it is for us to share it. And here we are on the Sunday after Christmas. And I'm a little depleted. Not defeated, just depleted. My batteries need charging. We're trying to preserve the batteries. All the batteries are now out of the candles that we shared on Christmas Eve. They've been put away. They're snug in their beds. The sanctuary is a little emptier. It's quieter. Things are a little slower. And in many ways, we realize the world's already starting to press back in a little bit. And this is where the fire will show itself. This is where the fire is going to really start to show itself for us, right in this time after, as the world presses in, to remember that God's life has been placed in human hands. God's life has been placed into our lives. And that's a flame that we carry like a lamp. It's not an ornament that we just sort of adorn and put on and take off from time to time. So what happens when God entrusts the light to a church? What happens when God entrusts the light to a believer? That's one of the big questions that I want you to leave continuing to ponder and turn over a little bit, recognizing that this is one of the hardest Sundays to preach because it is the season of Christmas, where within the 12 days, the tree is still up, the lights are still glowing. The poinsettia is, they're not quite what they once were, but they look pretty good. Y'all did a great job this year, not only procuring, but continuing to nourish them. Still looks like Christmas, feels a bit like Christmas, but as I said, we know the calendar keeps moving and life keeps coming, and so does death. Grief doesn't wait for our permission and doesn't make an appointment, and this year maybe you wanted it to. Maybe as you made your way across this season, there was a loss that loomed large. You may have come in here today with Christmas joy. You didn't even need any eggnog. You just had it. Some of you may have felt a little distracted about what was to come. And then I know some arrived today carrying the heavy weight of their losses. Shirley Pickett, whom I named at the outset, she and her family are woven so deeply into the knit of this church. And she died on Christmas Day. Her husband, Dick, died a little over a year ago. So many stories, so many deep memories today, sharing, as we did, also the awareness of Debbie Hunt's death. Losses and challenges too many to name. And so I'm going to say it again. Christmas is not an opportunity to cancel our grief. Christmas, in many ways, is God's response to all of that. Christmas is our assurance that the God of love who made this world, that the God of love who enters this world, the God of love who looks on you with compassion and care, has entered into this world where death still happens and will not, refuses to abandon us. But the story reader Matthew today gets dangerous almost immediately. And so we're going to be challenged to hang on to that assurance. We usually stop reading about this time with the angels, with the shepherds, maybe the magi, and then we set the story down. But Christmas isn't over for Matthew. What Matthew shows us is something that is more real, it's more earthy, and it's awfully challenging. That the flame that's kindled in the manger that we remembered on Christmas Eve has to be carried. Joseph carries the child into Egypt when Herod erupts with violence against children. He carries that flame through exile without any timeline or schedule, carries him home to a new home in Nazareth, and God speaks again. Finally, for us, we have to learn what it means to carry the flame as well. Even if we can't keep it, we carry it. And we release the ministries that are birthed with blessing. So there are about four movements we're going to take here through Matthew chapter 2, but one big pattern, that God entrusts the light to human hands that move when they're called, even when they're not certain about what is taking place around them. So that's lesson one. We're going to read verse 13, Matthew 2, verse 13. Now, after they had left, that is the Magi, the travelers from the east, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream and said, "Get up, take the child and his mother and flee to Egypt and remain there until I tell you, for Herod is about to search for the child to destroy him." And so lesson number one I want us to hear is this. Carrying the flame means responding to God before we understand it all. Now, I want to unpack that a little bit. This child that is just barely born, is now going to have to pack up or be packed up and move because the environment has grown very hostile. The political powers in Jerusalem feel threatened, and all of that fear starts to organize, and the violence is no longer theoretical, it's not abstract. Soldiers are going out with death orders to murder children under the age of 2, just to make sure that no king is going to ascend the throne in Herod's place. And in that context, God speaks again. It's in a dream, speaking to this very simple tradesman, a carpenter. In the middle of the night, God is speaking up to protect the Messiah and is depending on something that is woefully unpredictable. God is banking on human obedience, human responsiveness. Get up, take the child and his mother, flee to Egypt. It's abrupt, it's urgent, there's no long context, there's no brochure, there's no itinerary, there's no travel budget. Leave everything behind. God doesn't say, stay and I will make it safe for you here. God says, go and I will be with you. And so this isn't blind obedience in the sense of kind of robotic responsiveness. It's responding to God before they had it all figured out. Later on, Jesus surely had learned from this, because when he called disciples, how did he do it? He would say things like, follow me. Didn't hand out brochures, itineraries, or the schedule for the coming week. At other points, he would look at them and say, come and see. That there's some roads we make simply by walking them. There are some things we only come to understand by doing them. I learned this, Mackenzie, actually, when I did my first baptism, and I asked one of my mentors about it and said, you don't really know how to baptize until you baptize somebody. You don't know what kind of marriage you're going to facilitate until you do a marriage or two. You have no customary path until you start walking it. And that's the essence of following Jesus. And he did not simply dream that up. Instead, he saw it faithfully practiced in his household. Joseph and Mary didn't have all the answers, but they had heard clearly enough from God to know they needed to respond. And so they did. They didn't have it all mapped out, neither do we, but they moved. And so if you're living inside some sort of instruction, maybe you didn't ask for it, maybe it wasn't your dream instruction at this point in time, you can't really see how it's all going to shape up. Take heart. You're not alone as your eyes remain fixed on God and the ears of your heart remain attentive in prayer to how the Spirit is calling upon you. Carrying the flame means responding to God before you have it all figured out. Verses 14 and 15. Then Joseph got up, took the child and his mother by night, and went to Egypt, and remained there until the death of Herod. This was to fulfill what had been spoken by the Lord through the prophet. Out of Egypt, I have called my son. That's lesson 2. There's no way to bypass the valley of the shadow. There's no way around it. We used to sing that in preschool. Going on a bear hunt, remember? Walking through the forest, every once in a while you run into an obstacle you could not overcome. Can't go over it, can't go under it, have to go through it. There's no way to bypass the valley of the shadow. Matthew omits details too. He doesn't tell us on a scale of 1 to 10 how fearful Joseph might have been in packing in the dark and fleeing in the night from soldiers who were coming to town. He doesn't tell us about Mary's exhaustion postpartum, just trying to hold it all together and keep the baby fed and keep herself rested and nourished. And now we've got to do what? Got to go. Get up. Joseph got up. He and the mother took the child. And they move. And so in the same way, God entrusts the Messiah's survival again to something that is notoriously slippery. In the first one, it was human obedience. Now it's human faithfulness. Faithfulness by a man and woman who in the dark hear what they need to hear to begin the journey. It would have been easier to stay. And yet they start to go in motion. Joseph and Mary, probably perplexed, looked at each other sometimes and said, "Did you pack a map? I did not pack a map. How far is it to Egypt anyway? Where are we going to stay? How long are we going to stay? Do you know anybody down there? Do you know how to ask for coffee or a restroom in Egyptian? I don't either." And yet, without those resources, without an exit strategy or plan B, the text then tells us they remained there until the death of Herod. That's what God said. And so they are faithful without knowing how long that faithfulness would have to be practiced. I think sometimes we could talk a good game and say, "I'll be faithful as long as it's a week, maybe two." We know the expiration date of our personal faithfulness sometimes before we have to, in some ways, you know, let the pressure release out and do something foolish. It's a different thing altogether to do what is sometimes called a long obedience in the same direction. And walking that long road in one direction for a long, long time tells us what it means to be faithful. Last week, we celebrated Vance and LaFay's 73rd wedding anniversary. Talk about a long faithfulness in the same direction. And they're headed to a location that's not easy for them. In their spiritual memory, Egypt is loaded ground. It's where Joseph's ancestors were enslaved for 400 years. Moses led them there from freedom. Joseph is now taking the Messiah of God back into that place. And then the beloved is taken out of Egypt, just as Israel was emancipated before. And so sometimes, as much as we long for freedom, we realize that we have to go through the difficult lands of our bondage. That's how God works in reforming us into Christ-likeness. Doesn't allow us some sort of easy way to short-circuit our pain or to bypass the valleys of our shadows. But instead, as we walk our new paths, very often it takes us back to those places of pain, not only to be challenged, but also to challenge what once overtook us. Think about the addict who had to claw her way to sobriety, who then becomes an attendee and then eventually a sponsor for somebody else who's in recovery. Think about the person who's escaped a domestically violent situation and then volunteers time at the shelter to make sure others who have had to escape also have a safe place to be. Think about the refugee who might, as Harriet told the story, find the wondrous support of a church to be able to grow roots and to become self-sustaining, who then would have to return to those humble roots again with someone else and help them find their way. There is no way for us to avoid the pain of where we've been or where we are in order to become something new. We have to confront it, and sometimes we have to walk straight through it. And Joseph had to do that in returning to Egypt with Mary and with Jesus. And so the church, in many ways, exists to be that embodiment, that presence of God for each other. We named today a couple of households who are experiencing profound acute grief. And I've seen over and over again how touching it is when those of you who have lost someone dear to you will reach out to a bereaved spouse or a child and say, "Can I buy you lunch?" And simply listen and talk and share the knowing companionship that only losses like that can bring. That's the church. We don't bypass the hard roads either. In fact, where God calls us very often is alongside those who are in the midst of that valley. There's no way around it. Let's continue to read. Matthew 2, verses 16 through 18. When Herod saw that he'd been tricked by the Magi, he was infuriated. He sent and killed all the children in and around Bethlehem who were 2 years old and under, according to the time that he had learned from the Magi. Then was fulfilled what had been spoken through the prophet Jeremiah. A voice was heard in Ramah, wailing and loud lamentation, Rachel weeping for her children. She refused to be comforted because they are no more. The Holy Family has escaped, but every family doesn't escape. We know, historically, Herod had already murdered his own family to protect the throne. And now he orders the slaughter of children in and around Bethlehem, 2 years old and younger. The Magi said a king was born, then every child who might fit the description is going to die. Children die, and mothers weep, and the power oppresses. Innocence is slaughtered, and grief simply refuses easy comfort. Matthew quotes Jeremiah. He's reaching back to Rachel, weeping for her children, who are no more. Jesus is born into this world where there is so much grief already present, so much loss and violence. Power was brutalizing the vulnerable. It was not a time to be born, certainly not a time to be born poor. And yet he was among those who are the easiest targets for those in power, for Herod's rage, for the uncertainties of Egypt, for Rachel's weeping. Those are powerful elements in the story, but deep down, this is the nation of Israel's story. Herod's violence is an echo of Pharaoh's own violence against the Hebrew boys. The same story kind of keeps playing itself out, doesn't it? Sometimes we shorthand it, remembering that those who don't learn from history are doomed to repeat it. But what we know, whether it's in families, whether it's in communities, whether it's in nations or in the world, is that unless we confront honestly, clearly, with alternatives, the cycles that continue to perpetuate violence, often upon those who have no voice and no power of their own, if you don't do it, they will be repeated. They're inherited. They're passed on. And so if you learn to parent a certain way, you better believe that's how you're going to end up parenting, especially under stress, even if you didn't like it, unless you go through extreme efforts to make a change. If a church continues to behave the way it did 20, 30, 40 years ago, that's not a sin. It's simply recognizing that until there is an adaptation, until there's an intervention, at the root level, with fearless honesty, things repeat themselves. And these are the worst kinds of cycles that we're reading about in Matthew, the violence, the terror, the oppression. And this is where God enters first. Right in the middle of that spiritual darkness in our violent world. But we know that children still die. And we know that mothers still weep. And that power continues to take most of our hope. Sometimes when we look in, we don't even like what we see in our own souls. It can be kind of dark in there sometimes. We carry around a grief that we can't always name. Fear will keep us silent just so that we can keep everybody at peace. Sometimes we're just willfully blind to what's going on around us. People refuse to see what God is doing, and they close their eyes to those who need our voice and our help. They'd rather Herod stay in power, but keep the armies there, than risk a newborn king bringing real upheaval. Jesus grows up exposed to violence. He grows up as a refugee. He grows up knowing that children will die when power feels threatened. He grows up inside a story where grief is real and rescue takes a long time. On a mountainside, he would look with real compassion at those with tears in their eyes. He said, "Blessed are you who mourn, for you will be comforted." Not idle words, not good poetry. he experienced that, even as he shared it. Even now, as families pack in the dark, as children are carried across borders, because staying where they are means they're going to die, power is organizing itself to prevent it. And so, as we look at Jesus, we wonder where he stands among those that we consider issues. He sees humans, he sees families, and he sees a lot of darkness. That's why he came. And that's where he came, to be that light that kindles a new vision in just such a world. When Herod died, we read, an angel of the Lord suddenly appeared in a dream to Joseph in Egypt and said, get up, take the child and his mother, then go to the land of Israel. Remember, he was in Egypt. For those who were seeking your child's life are dead. Then Joseph got up, took the child and his mother, went to the land of Israel. But when he heard that Archelaus was ruling over Judea in the place of his father Herod, he was afraid to go there. And after being warned in a dream, he went. Joseph's dream life is just pitch perfect. After being warned in a dream, he went away to the district of Galilee. And there he made his home in a town called Nazareth, so that what would be spoken through the prophets might be fulfilled. He will be called a Nazarene. And so the pattern reverses now. God speaks, Joseph and Mary obey, the family moves, and the instruction's the same. Get up, take the child, go, but the direction is out of exile. Archelaus, it turns out, is as dangerous as his dad. So God speaks again, and Joseph nuances the plan. They end up in a little dusty, out-of-the-way place called Nazareth. Maybe 400 people live in Nazareth, tucked in the hills of Galilee. We don't even find mention of it in the Hebrew Bible. And it's the kind of place where eventually somebody would say something like, can anything good come from there? And it turns out the answer is yes. When Matthew ends the story, it's not a triumphant note, but it is with settling back in, that the child who had been carried through the valley of the shadow into exile and out now is growing up, growing roots. And so when this family finally settles, it's not resignation, this is as good as it's going to be, it's becoming rooted, becoming a part of a community that can fan the flames. Isn't that what we want too? There's such a world of difference between being stagnant and being rooted. Stagnation comes when there's no motion and the water just becomes moldy and algae-filled and mosquito-laden. To be rooted is something entirely different. The water goes to work, the air goes to work. There's growth and seed-bearing and fruit-bearing and change. And so their rootedness now becomes a place for Jesus to be nurtured, strengthened, and to launch into his ministry. And the fire that he carries survives because the God who enters the world fully has refused to let death have the final word on his journey. All that compassion that he learned early as his body and his life became to understand just how dependent he needed to be, with all that fear and with all that flight in his background, with a memory that's shaped by being in motion rather than living a very stable life, I think is part of what formed the character of someone who refused to save himself from the cross. And living out that pattern formed in him from the beginning, that same child that was carried into Egypt will one day carry a cross. What does that mean for us? I think it's lesson number four. We need to release what we love, or at least hold it loosely, so that we can bless the world. What happens when the light that God entrusts to us becomes a light that cannot stay where it is? If Jesus' story is one of such motion and redirection, how can we expect the lights in our community of faith to stay still? And we see it on display here with Mackenzie, of course. Mackenzie, your season of ministry here is coming to a close. And as she steps into that new call, she carries all those years of formation and everything that was invested in her, all the relationships, the faith that shaped this place and shaped her. She's going not to make Westwood look like Yates, I don't think. But every time she enters into a new relationship there, she carries a piece of this congregation's faith with her. Yates, as I said, doesn't send its throwaways or seconds out into the world. I'd like to think we send our very best out to bless the world. And if that's the standard, then I'm sorry to inform you, I will be here next week. But we may send you out into the world next. Because God's work is a lot bigger than what we want. And God's faithfulness means moving right when God says go. The early church grew because it kept letting people go. Apostles and teachers and leaders who didn't stay put. If the church ever tried to take hold or hold on to everyone, the gospel would have stalled and eventually stagnated. Some of you are navigating through transitions you didn't choose. And I don't know where you are on that spiritual roadmap. Maybe it was a loss that came to you and did not get your permission. Or a future that seems more uncertain than it ever did before. Those require faithfulness without all the certainty that gives us clarity. I looked out and I saw, you know, this morning somebody who arrived with donuts. And another person who arrived with breakfast food and knew that she had had an absolutely brutal week. And that's carrying the flame. That's carrying the fire. One of you got a call. And somebody needed help right away. And as important as worship is, knew it was time to leave early and head that way. On Christmas Eve, I saw one of you make a beeline for a very quiet young man who arrived a little late and I suspect wanted to slip out early enough not to attract attention. And you hooked him and you greeted him and learned his name and gave him a hug. That's carrying the fire. Because Matthew doesn't end this gospel in the same funeral parlor we seem to find ourselves in today. He ends it on a mountain in Galilee. The disciples are gathered around him, and Matthew tells us that some were worshiping and some were doubting, but they were all listening. And Jesus says this, "Go, therefore, and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit, teaching them to obey everything that I have commanded you. And remember, I am with you always to the end of the age. Go, make disciples, teach, baptize. Remember, I am with you." And that's not just for those 11 or so on the mountain. It's for Mackenzie as she steps into ministry at Westwood. It's for you when you walk into Harris Teeter. It's for every one of us who's crossing a threshold into a place that God is sending us. And it's not because we're qualified. It's not because we can control all the outcomes. It is because we've been entrusted with fire to carry it, to keep it safe, and to let it grow. So what's that going to mean for us in 2026? You can start this week. The first step is to move, literally. Take a step. Mackenzie is going to take a big step. She's headed toward another church. Others are going to navigate some transitions that don't quite feel comfortable yet. Some of us, it may be an internal shift, making a move to set down or pick up something that we have become persuaded is of God. The next thing you do is carry it. The light that we noticed as God's kindling here doesn't end on the 12th day of Christmas. We carry it into our classrooms. We carry it into hospital rooms. We carry it into planning meetings. We carry it into a lot of ordinary Sundays. We carry it everywhere. Westwood, Harris Teeter, wherever it may be, we're carrying the fire. And wherever God sends us next, we carry. The third thing that we do is we trust. Joseph and Mary didn't have a timeline. We don't either. But when God speaks and God acts, even if we find ourselves in exile, God will tell us the way home. Lastly, practice. Practice it each morning before you reach for your phone. If you can bear it, before you reach for the coffee. ask God one question. Where are you asking me to move today? Maybe it's somebody you've been avoiding. Maybe it's forgiving someone before they apologize to you. Maybe it's letting go of a timeline you've been clinging to. Maybe it's signing up to serve, even when you feel maybe like you're running a little bit on empty. You ask that question, and then you listen for the answer, and then you get up and move and carry and trust and practice again. It's more than just sort of spiritual calisthenics. This is the way we learn to carry the fire daily, because God doesn't stay right where you are. I'll make you safe. God says, go. I will be with you. Amen.